This is Audible.
Blackstone presents Wool by Hugh Howey. This book is read by Eduardo Ballerini. For Those Who Dare to Hope. Part 1. Holston. 1. The children were playing while Holston climbed to his death. He could hear them squealing, as only happy children do. While they thundered about frantically above, Holston took his time, each step methodical and ponderous, as he wound his way around and around the spiral staircase, old boots ringing out on metal treads. The treads, like his father's boots, showed signs of wear. Paint clung to them in feeble chips, mostly in the corners and undersides, where they were safe. Traffic elsewhere on the staircase sent dust shivering off in small clouds. Holston could feel the vibrations in the railing, which was worn down to the gleaming metal. That always amazed him, how centuries of bare palms and shuffling feet could wear down solid steel. One molecule at a time, he supposed. Each life might wear away a single layer, even as the silo wore away that life. Each step was slightly bowed from generations of traffic, the edge rounded down like a pouting lip. In the center, there was almost no trace of the small diamonds that once gave the treads their grip. Their absence could only be inferred from the pattern to either side, the small pyramidal bumps rising from the flat steel with their crisp edges and flecks of paint. Holston lifted an old boot to an old step, pressed down, and did it again. He lost himself in what the untold years had done, the ablation of molecules and lives, layers and layers ground to fine dust. And he thought, not for the first time, that neither life nor staircase had been meant for such an existence. The tight confines of that long spiral, threading through the buried silo like a straw in a glass, had not been built for such abuse. Like much of their cylindrical home, it seemed to have been made for other purposes, for functions long since forgotten. What was now used as a thoroughfare for thousands of people, moving up and down in repetitious daily cycles, seemed more apt, in Holston's view, to be used only in emergencies, and perhaps by mere dozens. Another floor went by, a pie-shaped division of dormitories. As Holston ascended the last few levels, this last climb he would ever take, the sounds of childlike delight rained down even louder from above. This was the laughter of youth, of souls who had not yet come to grips with where they lived, who did not yet feel the press of the earth on all sides, who in their minds were not buried at all, but alive, alive and unworn, dripping happy sounds down the stairwell, trills that were incongruous with Holston's actions, his decision and determination to go outside. As he neared the upper level, one young voice rang out above the others, and Holston remembered being a child in the silo, all the schooling and the games. Back then, the stuffy concrete cylinder had felt, with its floors and floors of apartments and workshops and hydroponic gardens and purification rooms with their tangles of pipes, like a vast universe, a wide expanse one could never fully explore, a labyrinth he and his friends could get lost in forever. But those days were more than 30 years distant. Holston's childhood now felt like something 2 or 3 lifetimes ago, something someone else had enjoyed, not him. He had an entire lifetime as sheriff, weighing heavy, blocking off that past. And more recently, there was this third stage of his life, a secret life beyond childhood and being sheriff. It was the last layers of himself ground to dust. 3 years spent silently waiting for what would never come, each day longer than any month from his happier lifetimes. At the top of the spiral stairway, Holston's hand ran out of railing. The curvy bar of worn steel ended as the stairwell emptied into the widest rooms of the entire silo complex, the cafeteria and the adjoining lounge. The playful squeals were level with him now. Darting bright shapes zagged between scattered chairs, playing chase. A handful of adults tried to contain the chaos. Holston saw Emma picking up scattered chalk and crayon from the stained tiles. Her husband, Clark, sat behind a table arranged with cups of juice and bowls of cornflour cookies. He waved at Holston from across the room. Halston didn't think to wave back, didn't have the energy or the desire. He looked past the adults and playing children to the blurry view beyond, projected on the cafeteria wall. It was the largest uninterrupted vista of their inhospitable world. A morning scene. Dawn's dim light coated lifeless hills that had hardly changed since Halston was a boy. They sat, just as they always had, while he had gone from playing chase among the cafeteria tables to whatever empty thing he was now. And beyond the stately rolling crest of these hills, the top of a familiar and rotting skyline caught the morning rays in feeble glints. Ancient glass and steel stood distantly where people, it was suspected, had once lived above ground. A child, ejected from the group like a comet, bumped into Halston's knees. He looked down and moved to touch the kid, Susan's boy. But just like a comet, the child was gone again, pulled back into the orbit of the others. Halston thought suddenly of the lottery he and Allison had won the year of her death. He still had the ticket. He carried it everywhere. One of these kids, maybe he or she would be two by now and tottering after the older children, could have been theirs. They had dreamed, like all parents do, of the double fortune of twins. They had tried, of course. After her implant was removed, they had spent night after glorious night trying to redeem that ticket, other parents wishing them luck, other lottery hopefuls silently praying for an empty year to pass. Knowing they only had a year, he and Allison had invited superstition into their lives, looking to anything for help. Tricks, like hanging garlic over the bed, that supposedly increased fertility. 2 dimes under the mattress for twins. A pink ribbon in Allison's hair. Smudges of blue dye under Halston's eyes. All of it ridiculous and desperate and fun. The only thing crazier would have been to not try everything, to leave some silly seance or tale untested. But it wasn't to be. Before their year was even out, the lottery had passed to another couple. It hadn't been for lack of trying. It had been a lack of time. A sudden lack of wife. Halston turned away from the games and the blurry view and walked toward his office, situated between the cafeteria and the silo's airlock. As he covered that ground, his thoughts went to the struggle that once took place there. A struggle of ghosts he'd had to walk through every day for the last 3 years. And he knew, if he turned and hunted that expansive view on the wall, if he squinted past the ever-worsening blur of cloudy camera lenses and airborne grime, if he followed that dark crease up the hill, that wrinkle that worked its way over the muddy dune toward the city beyond, he could pick out her quiet form. There on that hill, his wife could be seen. She lay like a sleeping boulder, the air and toxins wearing away at her, her arms curled under her head. Maybe. It was difficult to see, hard to make out clearly, even back before the blurring had begun anew. And besides, there was little to trust in that sight. There was much, in fact, to doubt. So Halston simply chose not to look. He walked through that place of his wife's ghostly struggle, where bad memories lay eternal, that scene of her sudden madness, and entered his office.
"Well, look who's up early," Martin said, smiling.
Halston's deputy closed a metal drawer on the filing cabinet, a lifeless cry singing from its ancient joints. He picked up a steaming mug, then noted Halston's solemn demeanor.
"You feeling okay, boss?"
Halston nodded. He pointed to the rack of keys behind the desk. "Holding cell," he said. The deputy's smile drooped into a confused frown. He set down the mug and turned to retrieve the key. While his back was turned, Halston rubbed the sharp, cool steel in his palm one last time, then placed the star flat on the desk. Marnes turned and held out the key. Halston took it.
"You need me to grab the mop?"
Deputy Marnes jabbed a thumb back toward the cafeteria. Unless someone was in cuffs, they only went into the cell to clean it. "No," Halston said. He jerked his head toward the holding cell, beckoning his deputy to follow. He turned, the chair behind the desk squeaking as Marnes rose to join him, and Halston completed his march. The key slid in with ease. There was a sharp clack from the well-built and well-maintained inner organs of the door. The barest squeak from the hinges, a determined step, a shove and a clank, and the ordeal was over.
"Boss?"
Halston held the key between the bars. Marnes looked down at it, unsure, but his palm came up to accept it.
"What's going on, boss?"
"Get the mayor," Holston said. He let out a sigh, that heavy breath he'd been holding for 3 years. "Tell her I want to go outside." 2. The view from the holding cell wasn't as blurry as it had been in the cafeteria, and Holston spent his final day in the silo puzzling over this. Could it be that the camera on that side was shielded against the toxic wind? Did each cleaner, condemned to death, put more care into preserving the view they'd enjoyed on their last day? Or was the extra effort a gift to the next cleaner, who would spend their final day in that same cell? Holston preferred this last explanation. It made him think longingly of his wife. It reminded him why he was there, on the wrong side of those bars, and willingly. As his thoughts drifted to Allison, he sat and stared out at the dead world some ancient peoples had left behind. It wasn't the best view of the landscape around their buried bunker, but it wasn't the worst, either. In the distance, low-rolling hills stood, a pretty shade of brown, like coffee mash with just the right amount of pig's milk in it. The sky above the hills was the same dull gray of his childhood, and his father's childhood, and his grandfather's childhood. The only moving feature on the landscape was the clouds. They hung full and dark over the hills. They roamed free like the herded beasts from the picture books. The view of the dead world filled up the entire wall of his cell, just like all the walls on the silo's upper level, each one full of a different slice of the blurry and ever blurrier wasteland beyond. Holston's little piece of that view reached from the corner by his cot, up to the ceiling, to the other wall, and down to the toilet. And despite the soft blur, like oil rubbed on a lens, it looked like a scene one could stroll out into. Like a gaping and inviting hole, oddly positioned across from forbidding prison bars. The illusion, however, convinced only from a distance. Leaning closer, Holston could see a handful of dead pixels on the massive display. They stood stark white against all the brown and gray hues. Shining with ferocious intensity, each pixel, Allison had called them stuck pixels, was like a square window to some brighter place. A hole the width of a human hair that seemed to beckon toward some better reality. There were dozens of them, now that he looked closer. Holston wondered if anyone in the silo knew how to fix them, or if they had the tools required for such a delicate job. Were they dead forever? Like Allison? Would all of the pixels be dead eventually? Holston imagined a day when half of the pixels were stark white, and then generations later, when only a few gray and brown ones remained, then a mere dozen, the world having flipped to a new state, the people of the silo thinking the outside world was on fire, the only true pixels now mistaken for malfunctioning ones. Or was that what Holston and his people were doing even now? Someone cleared their throat behind him. Holston turned and saw Mayor Johns standing on the other side of the bars, her hands resting in the belly of her overalls. She nodded gravely toward the cot.
"When the cell's empty, at night when you and Deputy Marnes are off duty, I sometimes sit right there and enjoy that very view."
Holston turned back to survey the muddy, lifeless landscape. It only looked depressing compared to scenes from the children's books, the only books to survive the uprising. Most people doubted those colors in the books, just as they doubted purple elephants and pink birds ever existed, but Holston felt that they were truer than the scene before him. He, like some others, felt something primal and deep when he looked at those worn pages splashed green and blue. Even so, when compared to the stifling silo, that muddy gray view outside looked like some kind of salvation, just the sort of open air men were born to breathe.
"Always seems a little clearer in here," John said. "The view, I mean."
Holston remained silent. He watched a curling piece of cloud break off and move in a new direction, blacks and grays swirling together.
"You get your pick for dinner," the mayor said. "It's tradition."
"You don't need to tell me how this works," Holston said, cutting John's off. "It's only been 3 years since I served Allison her last meal right here." He reached to spin the copper ring on his finger out of habit, forgetting he had left it on his dresser hours ago.
"Can't believe it's been that long,"
John's murmured to herself. Holston turned to see her squinting at the clouds displayed on the wall.
"Do you miss her?"
Holston asked venomously. Or do you just hate that the blur has had so much time to build?
John's eyes flashed his way a moment, then dropped to the floor.
You know I don't want this, not for any of you, but rules are the rules.
It's not to be blamed,
Holston said, trying to let the anger go.
I know the rules better than most.
His hand moved just a little toward the missing badge, left behind like his ring.
Hell, I enforced those rules for most of my life, even after I realized they were bullshit.
Johns cleared her throat.
Well, I won't ask why you chose this. I'll just assume it's because you'd be unhappier here.
Holston met her gaze, saw the film on her eyes before she was able to blink it away. Johns looked thinner than usual, comical in her gaping overalls. The lines in her neck and radiating from her eyes were deeper than he remembered, darker, and he thought the crack in her voice was genuine regret, not just age or her ration of tobacco. Suddenly Holston saw himself through John's eyes, a broken man sitting on a worn bench, his skin gray from the pale glow of the dead world beyond, and the sight made him dizzy. His head spun as it groped for something reasonable to latch onto, something that made sense. It seemed a dream, the predicament his life had become. None of the last 3 years seemed true. Nothing seemed true anymore. He turned back to the Tan Hills. In the corner of his eye, he thought he saw another pixel die, turning stark white. Another tiny window had opened, another clear view through an illusion he had grown to doubt.
Tomorrow will be my salvation, Holston thought savagely, even if I die out there.
I've been mayor too long, John said.
Holston glanced back and saw that her wrinkled hands were wrapped around the cold steel bars.
Our records don't go back to the beginning, you know. They don't go back before the uprising a century and a half ago. But since then, no mayor has sent more people to cleaning than I have.
I'm sorry to burden you, Holston said dryly.
I take no pleasure in it. That's all I'm saying. No pleasure at all.
Holston swept his hand at the massive screen.
But you'll be the first to watch a clear sunset tomorrow night, won't you?
He hated the way he sounded. Holston wasn't angry about his death, or life, or whatever came after tomorrow. But resentment over Allison's fate still lingered. He continued to see inevitable events from the past as avoidable, long after they'd taken their course.
You'll all love the view tomorrow, he said, more to himself than the mayor.
That's not fair at all, John said. The law is the law. You broke it. You knew you were breaking it.
Holston looked at his feet. The two of them allowed a silence to form. Mayor Johns was the one who eventually spoke.
You haven't threatened yet to not go through with it. Some of the others are nervous that you might not do the cleaning because you aren't saying you won't.
Holston laughed.
They'd feel better if I said I wouldn't clean the sensors.
He shook his head at the mad logic.
Everyone who sits there says they aren't going to do it, Johns told him. But then they do. It's what we've all come to expect.
Allison never threatened that she wouldn't do it,
Holston reminded her. But he knew what Johns meant. He himself had been sure Allison wouldn't wipe the lenses. And now he thought he understood what she'd been going through as she sat on that very bench. There were larger things to consider than the act of cleaning. Most who were sent outside were caught at something, were surprised to find themselves in that cell, their fate mere hours away. Revenge was on their mind when they said they wouldn't do it. But Allison and now Holston had bigger worries. Whether or not they'd clean was inconsequential. They had arrived here because they wanted, on some insane level, to be here. All that remained was the curiosity of it all. The wonder of the outside world beyond the projected veil of the wall screens.
So are you planning on going through with it or not?
Johns asked directly, her desperation evident.
You said it yourself, Holston shrugged. Everyone does it. There must be some reason, right?
He pretended not to care, to be disinterested in the why of the cleaning. But he had spent most of his life, the past 3 years especially, agonizing over the why. The question drove him nuts, and if his refusing to answer John's caused pain to those who had murdered his wife, he wouldn't be upset. John's rubbed her hands up and down the bars, anxious.
Can I tell them you'll do it? She asked.
Or tell them I won't. I don't care. It sounds like either answer will mean the same to them.
Johns didn't reply. Holston looked up at her, and the mayor nodded.
If you change your mind about the meal, let Deputy Marnes know. He'll be at the desk all night, as is tradition.
She didn't need to say. Tears came to Holston's eyes as he remembered that part of his former duties. He had manned that desk 12 years ago when Donna Parkins was put to cleaning, 8 years ago when it was Jack Brent's time. And he had spent a night clinging to the bars, lying on the floor, a complete wreck, 3 years ago when it was his wife's turn.
Mayor Johns turned to go. Sheriff,
Holston muttered before she got out of earshot.
I'm sorry?
Johns lingered on the other side of the bars, her gray, bushy brows hanging over her eyes.
It's Sheriff Marnes now, Holston reminded her. Not deputy.
Johns wrapped a steel bar with her knuckles.
Eat something, she said, and I won't insult you by suggesting you get some sleep.
3 years earlier.
You've got to be kidding me, Allison said. Honey, listen to this. You won't believe this. Did you know there was more than one uprising?
Holston looked up from the folder spread across his lap. Around him, scattered piles of paper covered the bed like a quilt. Stacks and stacks of old files to sort through, and new complaints to manage. Allison sat at her small desk at the foot of the bed. The two of them lived in one of the silo condos that had been subdivided only twice over the decades. It left room for luxuries like desks and wide non-bunk beds.
And how would I have known about that? He asked her.
His wife turned and tucked a strand of hair behind her ear. Holston jabbed a folder at her computer screen.
All day long you're unlocking secrets hundreds of years old, and I'm supposed to know about them before you do?
She stuck out her tongue.
It's an expression. It's my way of informing you. And why don't you seem more curious? Did you hear what I just said?
Holston shrugged.
I never would have assumed the one uprising we know about was the first, just that it was the most recent. If I've learned one thing from my job, it's that no crime or crazy mob is ever all that original.
He picked up a folder by his knee.
You think this is the first water thief the silo's known? Or that it'll be the last?
Allison's chair squealed on the tile as she turned to face him. The monitor on the desk behind her blinked with the scraps and fragments of data she had pulled from the silo's old servers, the remnants of information long ago deleted and overwritten countless times. Holston still didn't understand how the retrieval process worked, or why someone smart enough to come up with it was dumb enough to love him. But he accepted both as truth.
I'm piecing together a series of old reports, she said. If true, they mean something like our old uprising used to take place regularly, like once every generation or so.
There's a lot we don't know about the old times, Holston said.
He rubbed his eyes and thought about all the paperwork he wasn't getting done.
Maybe they didn't have a system for cleaning the sensors, you know? I'll bet back then the view upstairs just got blurrier and blurrier until people went crazy. There'd be a revolt or something, and then they'd finally exile a few people to set things straight. Or maybe it was just natural population control, you know, before the lottery.
Allison shook her head. I don't think so. I'm starting to think... She paused and glanced down at the spread of paperwork around Holston. The sight of all the logged transgressions seemed to make her consider carefully what she was about to say. I'm not passing judgment, not saying anyone was right or wrong or anything like that. I'm just suggesting that maybe the servers weren't wiped out by the rebels during the uprising. Not like we've always been told, anyway.
That got Holston's attention. The mystery of the blank servers, the empty past of the silo's ancestors, haunted them all. The erasure was nothing more than fuzzy legend.
He closed the folder he was working on and set it aside.
What do you think caused it? He asked his wife. Do you think it was an accident? A fire or a power outage?
He listed the common theories. Allison frowned.
No, she said.
She lowered her voice and looked around anxiously.
I think we wiped the hard drives. Our ancestors, I mean, not the rebels.
She turned and leaned toward the monitor, running her finger down a set of figures Holston couldn't discern from the bed. 20 years, she said. 18. 24.
Her fingers slid down the screen with a squeak.
28. 16. 15.
Holston plowed a path through the paperwork at his feet, putting the files back in stacks as he worked his way toward the desk. He sat on the foot of the bed, put a hand on his wife's neck, and peered over her shoulder at the monitor.
Are those dates?
He asked. She nodded. Just about every 2 decades there's a major revolt. This report catalogued them. It was one of the files deleted during the most recent uprising. Our uprising.
She said, our, like either of them or any of their friends had been alive at the time.
Holston knew what she meant, though. It was the uprising they had been raised in the shadow of, the one that seemed to have spawned them, the great conflict that hung over their childhoods, over their parents and grandparents. It was the uprising that filled whispers and occupied sideways glances.
And what makes you think it was us? That it was the good guys who wiped the servers?
She half turned and smiled grimly.
Who says we are the good guys?
Holston stiffened. He pulled his hand away from Allison's neck.
Don't start. Don't say anything that might—
I'm kidding, she said.
But it wasn't a thing to kid about. It was 2 steps from traitorous, from cleaning.
My theory is this, she said quickly, stressing the word theory. There's generational upheaval, right? I mean, for over 100 years, maybe longer. It's like clockwork. She pointed at the dates. But then, during the Great Uprising, the only one we've known about till now, someone wiped the servers, which I'll tell you, isn't as easy as pressing a few buttons or starting a fire. There's redundancies on top of redundancies. It would take a concerted effort, not an accident or any sort of rushed job or mere sabotage.
That doesn't tell you who's responsible,
Holston pointed out. His wife was a wizard with computers, no doubt, but sleuthing was not her bag. It was his.
What tells me something, she continued, is that there were uprisings every generation for all this time, but there hasn't been an uprising since.
Allison bit her lip.
Holston sat up straight.
He glanced around the room and allowed her observation to sink in. He had a sudden vision of his wife yanking his sleuthing bag out of his hands and making off with it.
So you're saying—
He rubbed his chin and thought this through.
You're saying that someone wiped out our history to stop us from repeating it?
Or worse—
She reached out and held his hand with both of hers. Her face had deepened from seriousness to something more severe.
What if the reason for the revolts was right there on the hard drives? What if some part of our known history, or some data from the outside, or maybe the knowledge of whatever it was that made people move in here long, long ago, what if that information built up some kind of pressure that made people lose their marbles, or go stir crazy, or just want out?
Holston shook his head.
I don't want you thinking that way, he cautioned her.
I'm not saying they were right to go nuts, she told him,
back to being careful.
But from what I've pieced together so far, this is my theory.
Holston gave the monitor an untrusting glance.
Maybe you shouldn't be doing this, he said. I'm not even sure how you're doing it, and maybe you shouldn't be.
Honey, the information is there. If I don't piece it together now, somebody else will at some point. You can't put the genie back in the bottle.
What do you mean?
I've already published a white paper on how to retrieve deleted and overwritten files. The rest of the IT department is spreading it around to help people who've unwittingly flushed something they needed.
I still think you should stop, he said. This isn't the best idea. I can't see any good coming of it.
No good coming from the truth? Knowing the truth is always good. And better that it's us discovering it than someone else, right?
Holston looked at his files. It had been 5 years since the last person was sent to cleaning. The view of the outside was getting worse every day, and he could feel the pressure, as sheriff, to find someone. It was growing, like steam building up in the silo, ready to launch something out. People got nervous when they thought the time was near. It was like one of those self-fulfilling prophecies where the nerves finally made someone twitch, then lash out or say something regretful, and then they'd find themselves in a cell, watching their last blurry sunset.
Holston sorted through the files all around him, wishing there was something in them.
He would put a man to his death tomorrow if it meant releasing that steam. His wife was poking some great, overly full balloon with a needle, and Holston wanted to get that air out of it before she poked too far. 4. Present time.
Halston sat on the lone steel bench in the airlock, his brain numb from lack of sleep and the surety of what lay before him. Nelson, the head of the cleaning lab, knelt in front of him and worked a leg of the white hazard suit over Halston's foot.
"We played around with the joint seals and added a second spray-on lining," Nelson was saying. "It should give you more time out there than anyone has had before."
This registered with Halston, and he remembered watching his wife go about her cleaning. The top floor of the silo, with its great screens showing the outside world, was usually empty for cleanings. The people inside couldn't bear to watch what they'd done. Or maybe they wanted to come up and enjoy a nice view without seeing what it took to get it. But Halston had watched. There was never any doubt that he would. He couldn't see Allison's face through her silver-masked helmet, couldn't see her thin arms through the bulky suit as she scrubbed and scrubbed with her wool pads. But he knew her walk, her mannerisms. He'd watched her finish the job, taking her time and doing it well, and then she had stepped back, looked in the camera one last time, waved at him, then turned to walk away. Like others before her, she had lumbered toward a nearby hill and had begun climbing up, trudging toward the dilapidated spires of that ancient and crumbling city just visible over the horizon. Halston hadn't moved the entire time. Even as she fell on the side of the hill, clutching her helmet, writhing while the toxins first ate away the spray-on linings, then the suit, and finally his wife, he hadn't moved.
"Other foot?"
Nelson slapped his ankle. Halston lifted his foot and allowed the tech to bunch the rest of the suit around his shins. Looking at his hands, at the black carbon undersuit he wore against his skin, Halston pictured it all dissolving off his body, sloughing away like flakes of dried grease from a generator's pipe, while the blood burst from his pores and pooled up in his lifeless suit.
"If you'll grab the bar and stand—"
Nelson was walking him through a routine he'd seen twice before. Once with Jack Brent, who had been belligerent and hostile right up to the end, forcing him as sheriff to stand guard by the bench. And once with his wife, whom he had watched get ready through the airlock's small porthole. Halston knew what to do from watching these others, but he still needed to be told. His thoughts were elsewhere. Reaching up, he grabbed the trapeze-like bar hanging above him and pulled himself upright. Nelson grabbed the sides of the suit and yanked them up to Halston's waist. Two empty arms flapped at either side.
"Left hand here?"
Halston numbly obeyed. It was surreal to be on the other side of this mechanical death walk of the condemned. Halston had often wondered why people complied, why they just went along. Even Jack Brent had done what he was told, as foul-mouthed and verbally abusive as he'd been. Allison had done it quietly, just like this, Halston thought, as he inserted one hand and then the other. The suit came up, and Halston thought that maybe people went along with it because they couldn't believe it was happening. None of it was real enough to rebel against. The animal part of his mind wasn't made for this, to be calmly ushered to a death it was perfectly aware of.
"Turn?"
He did. There was a tug at the small of his back, and then a noisy zipping sound up to his neck. Another tug, another zip. Two layers of futility. The crunch of industrial Velcro over the top. Pats and double checks. Halston heard the hollow helmet slide off its shelf. He flexed his fingers inside the puffy gloves while Nelson checked over the dome's innards.
"Let's go over the procedure one more time."
"It's not necessary," Halston said quietly.
Nelson glanced toward the airlock door leading back to the silo. Halston didn't need to look to know someone was likely watching.
"Bear with me," Nelson said. "I have to do it by the book."
Halston nodded, but he knew there wasn't any book. Of all the mystic oral traditions passed through silo generations, none matched the cult-like intensity of the suitmakers and the cleaning techs. Everyone gave them their space. The cleaners might perform the physical act, but the techs were the people who made it possible. These were the men and women who maintained the view to that wider world beyond the silo's stifling confines. Nelson placed the helmet on the bench.
"You got your scrubbers here."
He patted the wool pad stuck to the front of the suit. Halston pulled one off with a ripping sound.
studied the whorls and curls of the rough material, and stuck it back on. 2 squirts from the cleaning bottle before you scrub with the wool, then dry with this towel, then put the ablating films on last. He patted the pockets in order, even though they were clearly labeled and numbered, upside down so Holston could read them, and color-coded. Holston nodded and met the tech's eyes for the first time. He was surprised to see fear there, fear he had learned well to notice in his profession. He almost asked Nelson what was wrong before it occurred to him. The man was worried all these instructions were for naught, that Holston would walk out, like everyone in the silo feared all cleaners would, and not do his duty. Not clean up for the people whose rules against dreaming of a better place, had doomed him. Or was Nelson worried that the expensive and laborious gear he and his colleagues had built, using those secrets and techniques handed down from well before the uprising, would leave the silo and rot to no purpose? "You okay?" Nelson asked. "Anything too tight?" Holston glanced around the airlock. "My life is too tight," he wanted to say. "My skin is too tight. The walls are too tight." He just shook his head. "I'm ready," he whispered. It was the truth. Holston was oddly and truly very much ready to go. And he remembered suddenly how ready his wife had been as well. 5. 3 years earlier.
"I want to go out. I want to go out. I want to go out."
Holston arrived at the cafeteria in a sprint. His radio was still squawking, Deputy Marnes yelling something about Allison. Holston hadn't even taken the time to respond, had just bolted up 3 flights of stairs toward the scene.
"What's going on?"
he asked. He swam through the crowd by the door and found his wife writhing on the cafeteria floor, held down by Connor and 2 food staff employees.
"Let her go."
He slapped their hands off his wife's shins and was nearly rewarded by one of her boots to his chin.
"Settle down," he said.
He reached for her wrists, which were twisting this way and that, to get out of the desperate grips of grown men.
"Baby, what the hell is going on?"
"She was running for the airlock,"
Connor said through grunts of exertion. Percy corralled her kicking feet, and Holston didn't stop him. He saw now why 3 men were needed. He leaned close to Allison, making sure she saw him. Her eyes were wild, peeking through a curtain of disheveled hair.
"Allison, baby, you've got to settle down."
"I want to go out. I want to go out."
Her voice had quieted, but the words kept tumbling out.
"Don't say that," Holston told her.
Chills ran through his body at the sound of the grave utterances. He held her cheeks.
"Baby, don't say that."
But some part of him knew, in a jolting flash, what it meant. He knew it was too late. The others had heard. Everyone had heard. His wife had signed her own death certificate. The room spun around Holston as he begged Allison to be quiet. It was like he had arrived at the scene of some horrible accident, some mishap in the machine shop, to find a person he loved wounded. Arrived to find them alive and kicking, but knowing at a glance that the injury was fatal. Holston felt warm tears streak down his cheeks as he tried to wipe the hair from her face. Her eyes finally met his, stopped their fevered swirling, and locked onto his with awareness. And for a moment, just a second, before he could wonder if she'd been drugged or abused in any way, a spark of calm clarity registered there, a flash of sanity, of cool calculation. And then it was blinked away, and her eyes went wild again as she begged to be let out, over and over.
"Lift her up," Holston said.
His husband's eyes swam behind tears while he allowed his dutiful sheriff self to intervene. There was nothing for it but to lock her up, even as he wanted no more than room enough to scream.
"That way,"
he told Connor, who had both hands under her twisting shoulders. He nodded toward his office and the holding cell beyond. Just past that, down at the end of the hall, the bright yellow paint on the great airlock door stood out, serene and menacing, silent and waiting. Once in the holding cell, Allison immediately calmed. She sat on the bench, no longer struggling or blabbering, as if she'd only stopped by to rest and enjoy the view. Holston was now the writhing wreck.
He paced outside the bars and blubbered unanswered questions while Deputy Marnes and the mayor handled his procedural work. The two of them were treating Holston and his wife both like patients. And even as Holston's mind spun with the horror of the past half hour, in the back of his sheriff brain, where he was always alert for the rising tensions in the silo, he was dimly aware of the shock and rumors trembling through walls of concrete and rebar. The enormous pent-up pressure of the place was now hissing through the seams in whispers.
"Sweetheart, you've got to talk to me," he pleaded again and again.
He stopped his pacing and twisted the bars in his hands. Allison kept her back to him. She gazed at the wall screen, at the brown hills and gray sky and dark clouds. Now and then a hand came up to brush hair out of her face, but otherwise she didn't move or speak. Only when Holston's key had gone into the lock, not long after they'd wrestled her in and shut the door, did she utter a single, "Don't," that had convinced him to remove it. While he pleaded and she ignored, the machinations of the looming cleaning gyred through the silo. Tex rumbled down the hallway as a suit was sized and readied. Cleaning tools were prepped in the airlock. A canister hissed somewhere as argon was loaded into the flushing chambers. The commotion of it sporadically rumbled past the holding cell where Holston stood gazing at his wife. Chattering Tex went dreadfully silent as they squeezed past. They didn't even seem to breathe in his presence. Hours passed, and Allison refused to talk, behavior that created its own stir in the silo. Holston spent the entire day blubbering through the bars, his brain on fire with confusion and agony. It had happened in a single moment, the destruction of all that he knew. He tried to wrap his brain around it while Allison sat in the cell, gazing out at the dismal land, seemingly pleased with her far worse status as a cleaner. It was after dark when she finally spoke, after her last meal had been silently refused for the final time, after the Tex had finished in the airlock, closing the yellow door and retiring for a sleepless night. It was after his deputy had gone for the night, patting Holston on the shoulder twice. What felt like many hours after that, when Holston was near to passing out in fatigue from his crying and hoarse remonstrations, long after the hazy sun had settled over the hills visible from the cafeteria and lounge, the hills that hid the rest of that distant, crumbling city, in the near dark left in the holding cell, Allison whispered something almost inaudible.
"It's not real."
That's what Holston thought he heard. He stirred. "Baby?" He gripped the bars and pulled himself up to his knees.
"Honey," he whispered, wiping the crust from his cheeks.
She turned. It was like the sun changing its mind and rising back over the hills. That she'd acknowledged him, gave him hope. It choked him up, causing him to think this had all been a sickness, a fever, something they could have Doc write up to excuse her for everything she'd uttered. She'd never meant it. She was saved just by snapping out of it, and Holston was saved just by seeing her turn to him.
"Nothing you see is real," she said quietly.
She seemed calm of body, even as her craziness continued, condemning her with forbidden words. "Come talk to me," Holston said. He waved her to the bars. Allison shook her head. She patted the cot's thin mattress beside her. Holston checked the time. It was long past visiting hours. He could be sent to cleaning just for doing what he was about to do. The key went into the lock without hesitation. A metallic click rang out impossibly loud. Holston stepped inside with his wife and sat beside her. It killed him to not touch her, to not wrap her up or drag her out to some safe place, back to their bed, where they could pretend it had all been a bad dream. But he didn't dare move. He sat and twisted his hands together while she whispered,
"It doesn't have to be real. Any of this. None of this."
She looked to the screen. Holston leaned so close he could smell the dried sweat from the day's struggle.
"Baby, what's going on?"
Her hair stirred with the breath from his words. She reached out and rubbed the darkening display, feeling the pixels.
"It could be morning right now and we'd never know. There could be people outside."
She turned and looked at him.
"They could be watching us," she said with a sinister grin.
Holston held her gaze. She didn't seem crazy at all, not like earlier. Her words were crazy, but she didn't seem to be. "Where did you get that idea?" he asked. He thought he knew, but he asked anyway. "Did you find something on the hard drives?" He'd heard that she had run straight from her lab toward the airlock, already barking her madness. Something had happened while she was at work. "What did you find?"
"There's more deleted than just from the uprising," she whispered. "Of course there would be. Everything is deleted. All the recent stuff, too."
She laughed. Her voice got suddenly loud, and her eyes lost focus.
"Emails you never sent me, I bet."
"Honey." Holston dared to reach for her hands, and she didn't pull away. He held them. "What did you find? Was it an email? Who was it from?" She shook her head.
"No, I found the programs they use, the ones that make pictures on the screens that look so real."
She looked back to the quickening dusk.
"IT," she said. "IT. They're the ones. They know. It's a secret that only they know."
She shook her head. "What secret?" Holston couldn't tell if this was nonsense or important. He only knew that she was talking.
"But now I know. And you will too. I'll come back for you, I swear. This will be different. We'll break the cycle, you and me. I'll come back and we'll go over that hill together."
She laughed. "If it's there," she said loudly. "If that hill is there and it's green, we'll go over it together." She turned to him.
"There is no uprising. Not really. There's just a gradual leak. Just the people who know, who want out."
She smiled.
"They get to go out," she said. "They get just what they ask for. I know why they clean. Why they say they won't, but why they do. I know. I know. And they never come back. They wait and wait and wait. But I won't. I'll come right back. This'll be different."
Holston squeezed her hands. Tears were dripping off his cheeks. "Baby, why are you doing this?" He felt like she wanted to explain herself now that the silo was dark and they were all alone.
"I know about the uprisings," she said.
Holston nodded. "I know you told me there were others."
"No."
Allison pulled away from him, but it was only to make space so she could look him in the eyes. Hers were no longer wild as before.
"Holston, I know why the uprisings took place. I know why."
Allison bit her lower lip. Holston waited, his body tense.
"It was always over the doubt, the suspicion that things weren't as bad out there as they seemed. You felt that, right? That we could be anywhere, living a lie?"
Holston knew better than to answer, to even twitch. Broaching this subject led to cleaning. He sat frozen and waited.
"It was probably the younger generations," Allison said. "Every 20 years or so. They wanted to push further, to explore, I think. Don't you ever feel that urge? Didn't you when you were younger?"
Her eyes lost focus.
"Or maybe it was the couples, newly married, who were driven to madness when they were told they couldn't have kids in this damned limited world of ours. Maybe they were willing to risk everything for that chance."
Her eyes focused on something far away. Perhaps she was seeing that lottery ticket they had yet to redeem, and now never would. She looked back at Holston. He wondered if he could be sent to cleaning even for his silence, for not yelling her down as she uttered every one of the great forbidden words.
"It could even have been the elderly residents," she said, "cooped up too long, no longer afraid in their final years, maybe wanting to move out and make room for the others, for the few precious grandchildren. Whoever it was, whoever, every uprising took place because of this doubt, this feeling that we're in the bad place right here."
She looked around the cell.
"You can't say that," Holston whispered. "That's the great offense."
Allison nodded.
"Expressing any desire to leave, yes, the great offense. Don't you see why? Why is that so forbidden? Because all the uprisings started with that desire, that's why."
"You get what you ask for,"
Holston recited. Those words drilled into his head since youth. His parents had warned him, their only precious child, never to want out of the silo. Never even to think it. Don't let it cross your mind. It was instant death, that thought, and it would be the destruction of their one and only. He looked back at his wife. He still didn't understand her madness, this decision. So she had found deleted programs that could make worlds on computer screens look real.
What did that mean? Why do this?
Why? He asked her.
Why do it this way? Why didn't you come to me?
There has to be a better way to find out what's going on. We could start by telling people what you're finding on those drives.
And be the ones who start the next great uprising?
Allison laughed.
Some of the madness was still there. Or maybe it was just an intense frustration and boiling anger. Perhaps a great, multi-generational betrayal had pushed her to the edge.
No thanks, she said, her laughter subsiding. Damn them if they stay here. I'm only coming back for you.
You don't come back from this, Holston said angrily. You think the banished are still out there? You think they choose not to come back because they feel betrayed by us?
Why do you think they do the cleaning?
Allison asked.
Why do they pick up their wool and set to work without hesitation?
Holston sighed. He felt the anger in him draining away. No one knows why, he said.
But why do you think?
We've talked about this, he said. How many times have we discussed this? He was sure all couples whispered their theories when they were alone. He looked past Allison as he remembered those times. He looked to the wall and saw the moon's position, and read in it the night's hour. Their time was limited. His wife would be gone tomorrow. That simple thought came often, like lightning from stormy clouds. Everyone has theories, he said. We've shared ours countless times.
Let's just...
But now you know something new,
Allison told him. She let go of his hand and brushed the hair from her face.
You and I know something new, and now it all makes sense. It makes perfect sense, and tomorrow I'll know for sure.
Allison smiled. She patted Holston's hand as if he were a child.
And one day, my love, you will know it too.
6. Present time. The first year without her, Holston had waited, buying into her insanity, distrusting the sight of her on that hill, hoping she'd come back. He'd spent the first anniversary of her death scrubbing the holding cell clean, washing the yellow airlock door, straining for some sound, some knock, that would mean the ghost of his wife was back to set him free. When it didn't happen, he began to consider the alternative, going out after her. He'd spent enough days, weeks, months, going through her computer files, reading some of what she had pieced together, making sense of half of it, to become half mad himself. His world was a lie, he came to believe, and without Allison in it, he had nothing to live for, even if it were truth. The second anniversary of her departure was his year of cowardice. He had walked to work, the poisonous words in his mouth, his desire to go out, but he had choked them down at the last second. He and Deputy Marnes had gone on patrol that day with the secret of how near he'd come to death burning inside of him. That was a long year of cowardice, of letting Allison down. The first year had been her failure. Last year had been his. But no more. Now, one more year later, he was alone in the airlock, wearing a cleaning suit full of doubts and convictions. The silo was sealed off behind him, that thick yellow door bolted tight, and Holston thought that this was not how he'd thought he'd die, or what he had hoped would become of him. He had thought he would remain in the silo forever, his nutrients going as the nutrients of his parents had, into the soil of the 8th-floor dirt farm. It seemed a lifetime ago that he had dreamed of a family, of his own child, a fantasy of twins, or another lottery win, a wife to grow old with. A klaxon sounded on the other side of the yellow doors, warning everyone but him away. He was to stay. There was nowhere else for him to go. The argon chambers hissed, pumping the room full of the inert gas. After a minute of this, Holston could feel the pressure of the air as it crinkled the cleaning suit tight around his joints. He breathed the oxygen circulating inside his helmet and stood before the other door, the forbidden door, the one to the awful outside world, and waited. There was a metal groan from pistons deep within the walls. The sacrificial plastic curtains covering the interior of the airlock wrinkled from the pressure of the built-up argon. These curtains would be incinerated inside the airlock while Holston cleaned. The area would be scrubbed before nightfall, made ready for the next cleaning. The great metal doors before him shuddered, and then a shaft of incredible space appeared at their joint, widening as the doors withdrew into the jam. They wouldn't open all the way,
not like they were once designed to. The risk of invading air had to be minimized. An argon torrent hissed through the gap, dulling to a roar as the space grew. Holston pressed close, as horrified at himself for not resisting as he'd previously been perplexed by the actions of others. Better to go out, to see the world one time with his own eyes, than to be burned alive with the plastic curtains. Better to survive a few moments more. As soon as the opening was wide enough, Holston squeezed through, his suit catching and rubbing at the doors. There was a veil of fog all around him as the argon condensed in the less pressurized air. He stumbled forward blindly, pawing through the soft cloud. While he was still in that mist, the outer doors groaned and began closing. The clacks and howls behind were swallowed by the press of thick steel against thick steel, locking him and the toxins out, while cleansing fires began to rage inside the airlock, destroying any contamination that had leaked its way inside. Holston found himself at the bottom of a concrete ramp, a ramp that led up. His time felt short. There was a constant reminder thrumming in the back of his skull. Hurry, hurry! His life was ticking away. He lumbered up the ramp, confused that he wasn't already above ground, so used as he was to seeing the world and the horizon from the cafeteria and lounge, which were on the same level as the airlock. He shuffled up the narrow ramp, walls of chipped concrete to either side, his visor full of a confusing, brilliant light. At the top of the ramp, Holston saw the heaven into which he'd been condemned for his simple sin of hope. He whirled around, scanning the horizon, his head dizzy from the sight of so much green. Green hills, green grass, green carpet beneath his feet. Holston whooped in his helmet. His mind buzzed with the sight. Hanging over all the green, there was the exact hue of blue from the children's books, the white clouds untainted, the movement of living things flapping in the air. Holston turned around and around, taking it in. He had a sudden memory of his wife doing the same. He had watched her awkwardly, slowly turning, almost as if she were lost or confused or considering whether to do the cleaning at all. The cleaning. Holston reached down and pulled a wool pad from his chest. The cleaning! He knew in a dizzying rush, a torrent of awareness, why, why, why? He looked where he always assumed the tall circular wall of the uppermost silo floor would be, but of course that wall was buried. All that stood behind him was a small mound of concrete, a tower no more than 8 or 9 feet tall. A metal ladder ran up one side, antennae bristled from the top, and on the side facing him, on all the sides he saw as he approached, were the wide, curving fisheye lenses of the silo's powerful cameras. Holston held out his wool and approached the first. He imagined the view of himself from inside the cafeteria, staggering forward, becoming impossibly large. He had watched his wife do the same thing 3 years ago. He remembered her waving. He had thought at the time for balance, but had she been telling him something? Had she been grinning like a fool, as wide as he was grinning now, while she remained hidden behind that silver visor? Had her heart been pounding with foolish hope while she sprayed, scrubbed, wiped, applied? Holston knew the cafeteria would be empty. There was no one left who loved him enough to watch. But he waved anyway, and for him it wasn't the raw anger he imagined many might have cleaned with. It wasn't the knowledge that they in the silo were condemned and the condemned set free. It wasn't the feeling of betrayal that guided the wool in his hand in small circular motions. It was pity. It was raw pity and unconstrained joy. The world blurred, but in a good way, as tears came to Holston's eyes. His wife had been right. The view from inside was a lie. The hills were the same. He'd recognized them at a glance after so many years of living with them. But the colors were all wrong. The screens inside the silo, the programs his wife had found, they somehow made the vibrant greens look gray. They somehow removed all signs of life. Extraordinary life. Holston polished the grime off the camera lens and wondered if the gradual blurring was even real. The grime certainly was. He saw it as he rubbed it away. But was it simple dirt, rather than some toxic, airborne grime? Could the program Allison discovered modify only what was already seen? Holston's mind spun with so many new facts and ideas. He was like an adult child, born into a wide world,
so much to piece together all at once that his head throbbed. The blur is real, he decided, as he cleaned the last of the smear from the second lens. It was an overlay, like the false grays and browns the program must have used to hide that green field and this blue sky dotted with puffy white. They were hiding from them a world so beautiful, Holston had to concentrate not to just stand still and gape at it. He worked on the second of the four cameras and thought about those untrue walls beneath him, taking what they saw and modifying it. He wondered how many people in the silo knew. Any of them? What kind of fanatical devotion would it take to maintain this depressing illusion? Or was this a secret from before the last uprising? Was it an unknown lie, perpetuated through the generations? A fibbing set of programs that continued to hum away on the silo computers with nobody aware? Because if someone knew, if they could show anything, why not something nice? The uprisings. Maybe it was just to prevent them from happening over and over again. Holston applied an ablative film to the second sensor and wondered if the ugly live and unpleasant outside world was some misguided attempt to keep people from wanting out. Could someone have decided that the truth was worse than a loss of power, of control? Or was it something deeper and more sinister? A fear of unabashed, free, many-as-you-like children. So many horrible possibilities. And what of Allison? Where was she? Holston shuffled around the corner of the concrete tower toward the third lens, and the familiar but strange skyscrapers in the distant city came into view. Only there were more buildings than usual there. Some stood to either side, and an unfamiliar one loomed in the foreground. The others, the ones he knew by heart, were whole and shining, not twisted and jagged. Holston gazed over the crest of the verdant hills and imagined Allison walking over them at any minute. But that was ridiculous. How would she know he'd been expelled on this day? Would she remember the anniversary, even after he'd missed the last two? Holston cursed his former cowardice, the years wasted. He would have to go to her, he decided. He had a sudden impulse to do just that, to tear off his helmet and bulky suit and scamper up the hill in nothing but his carbon undersuit, breathing in deep gulps of crisp air and laughing all the way to his waiting wife in some vast, unfathomable city full of people and squealing children. But no. There were appearances to keep, illusions to maintain. He wasn't sure why, but it was what his wife had done, what all the other cleaners before him had done. Holston was now a member of that club, a member of the out group. There was a press of history, of precedent, to obey. They had known best. He would complete his performance for the in-group he had just joined. He wasn't sure why he was doing it, only that everyone before him had. And look at the secret they all shared. That secret was a powerful drug. He knew only to do what he had been told, to follow the numbers on the pockets, to clean mechanically while he considered the awesome implications of an outside world so big one couldn't live to see it all, couldn't breathe all the air, drink all the water, eat all the food. Holston dreamed of such things while he dutifully scrubbed the third lens, wiped, applied, sprayed, then moved to the last. His pulse was audible in his ears. His chest pounded in that constricting suit. Soon, soon, he told himself. He used the second wool pad and polished the grime off the final lens. He wiped and applied and sprayed a final time, then put everything back in its place, back in the numbered pouches, not wanting to spoil the gorgeous and healthy ground beneath his feet. Done, Holston stepped back, took one last look at the nobodies not watching from the cafeteria and lounge, then turned his back on those who had turned their backs on Allison and all the others before her. There was a reason nobody came back for the people inside, Holston thought, just as there was a reason everyone cleaned, even when they said they wouldn't. He was free. He was to join the others, and so he strolled toward that dark crease that ran up the hill, following in his wife's footsteps, aware that some familiar boulder, long sleeping, no longer lay there. That, too, Holston decided, had been nothing more than another awful, pixelated lie. 7. Holston was a dozen paces up the hill, still marveling at the bright grass at his feet and the brilliant sky above,
when the first pang lurched in his stomach. It was a writhing cramp, something like intense hunger. At first he worried he was going too fast, first with the cleaning and now with his impatient shuffling in that cumbersome suit. He didn't want to take it off until he was over the hill, out of sight, maintaining whatever illusion the walls in the cafeteria held. He focused on the tops of the skyscrapers and resigned himself to slowing down, to calming down. One step at a time. Years and years of running up and down 30 flights of stairs should have made this nothing. Another cramp, stronger this time. Holston winced and stopped walking, waiting for it to pass. When did he eat last? Not at all yesterday. Stupid. When did he last use the bathroom? Again, he couldn't remember. He might need to get the suit off earlier than he'd hoped. Once the wave of nausea passed, he took a few more steps, hoping to reach the top of the hill before the next bout of pain. He only got another dozen steps in before it hit him. More severe this time. Worse than anything he'd ever felt. Holston retched from the intensity of it, and now his dry stomach was a blessing. He clutched his abdomen as his knees gave out in a shiver of weakness. He crashed to the ground and groaned. His stomach was burning, his chest on fire. He managed to crawl forward a few feet, sweat dripping from his forehead and splashing on the inside of his helmet. He saw sparks in his vision. The entire world went bright white several times, like lightning strikes. Confused and senseless, he crawled ever upward, moving laboriously, his startled mind still focused on his last clear goal, cresting that hill. Again and again his view shimmered, his visor letting in a solid bright light before it flickered away. It became difficult to see. Holston ran into something before him, and his arm folded, his shoulder crashing to the ground. He blinked and gazed forward, up the hill, waiting for a clear sight of what lay ahead, but saw only infrequent strobes of green grass. And then his vision completely disappeared. All was black. Holston clawed at his face, even as his stomach tangled in a new torturous knot. There was a glow, a blinking in his vision, so he knew he wasn't blind. But the blinking seemed to be coming from inside his helmet. It was his visor that had become suddenly blind. Not him. Holston felt for the latches on the back of the helmet. He wondered if he'd used up all his air. Was he asphyxiating? Being poisoned by his own exhalations? Of course. Why would they give him more air than he needed for the cleaning? He fumbled for the latches with his bulky gloves. They weren't meant for this. The gloves were part of his suit a single piece zipped up twice at the back and velcroed over. It wasn't meant to come off, not without help. Holston was going to die in it. Poison himself, choke on his own gases. And now he knew true fear of containment, a true sense of being closed in. The silo was nothing to this as he scrambled for release, as he writhed in pain inside his tailored coffin. He squirmed and pounded at the latches, but his padded fingers were too big, and the blindness made it worse, made him feel smothered and trapped. Holston retched again in pain. He bent at the waist, hands spread in the dirt, and felt something sharp through his glove. He fumbled for the object and found it. A jagged rock. A tool. Holston tried to calm himself. His years of enforcing calm, of soothing others, of bringing stability to chaos, came back to him. He gripped the rock carefully, terrified of losing it to his blindness, and brought it up to his helmet. There was a brief thought of cutting away his gloves with the rock, but he wasn't sure his sanity or air would last that long. He jabbed the point of the rock at his armored neck, right where the latch should have been. He heard the crack as it landed. Crack, crack. Pausing to probe with his padded finger, retching again, Holston took more careful aim. There was a click instead of a crack. A sliver of light intruded as one side of the helmet came free. Holston was choking on his exhalations, on the stale and used air around him. He moved the rock to his other hand and aimed for the second latch. Two more cracks before it landed, and the helmet popped free. Holston could see. His eyes burned from the effort, from not being able to breathe, but he could see. He blinked the tears away and tried to suck in a deep, crisp, revitalizing lungful of blue air. What he got instead was like a punch to the chest. Holston gagged.
He threw up spittle and stomach acid, the very lining of him trying to flee. The world around him had gone brown. Brown grass and gray skies. No green, no blue, no life. He collapsed to one side, landing on his shoulder. His helmet lay open before him, the visor black and lifeless. There was no looking through the visor. Holston reached for it, confused. The outside of the visor was coated silver, the other side was nothing. No glass. A rough surface. Wires leading in and out of it. A display gone dark. Dead pixels. He threw up again. Wiping his mouth feebly, looking down the hill, he saw the world with his naked eyes as it was, as he'd always known it to be, desolate and bleak. He let go of the helmet, dropping the lie he had carried out of the silo with him. He was dying. The toxins were eating him from the inside. He blinked up at the black clouds overhead, roaming like beasts. He turned to see how far he had gotten, how far it was to the crest of the hill. And he saw the thing he had stumbled into while crawling. A boulder, sleeping. It hadn't been there in his visor, hadn't been a part of the lie on that little screen, running one of the programs Allison had discovered. Holston reached out and touched the object before him, the white suit flaking away like brittle rock, and he could no longer support his head. He curled up in pain from the slow death overtaking him, holding what remained of his wife, and thought, with his last agonizing breath, what this death of his must look like to those who could see. This curling and dying in the black crack of a lifeless brown hill, a rotting city standing silent and forlorn over him. What would they see? Anyone who had chosen to watch. Part 2. Proper Gauge. 8. Her knitting needles rested in a leather pouch in pairs, two matching sticks of wood, side by side like the delicate bones of the wrist wrapped in dried and ancient flesh. Wood and leather. Artifacts like clues handed down from generation to generation, innocuous winks from her ancestors, harmless things like children's books and wood carvings that managed to survive the uprising and the purge. Each clue stood as a small hint of a world beyond their own, a world where buildings stood above ground, like the crumbling ruins visible over the gray and lifeless hills. After much deliberation, Mayor Johns selected a pair of needles. She always chose carefully, for proper gauge was critical. Too small a needle, and the knitting would prove difficult, the resulting sweater too tight and constricting. Too large a needle, on the other hand, would create a garment full of large holes. The knitting would remain loose. One would be able to see straight through it. Her choice made, the wooden bones removed from their leather wrist, Johns reached for the large ball of cotton yarn. It was hard to believe, weighing that knot of twisted fibers, that her hands could make of it something ordered, something useful. She fished for the end of the yarn, dwelling on how things came to be. Right now her sweater was little more than a tangle and a thought. Going back, it had once been bright fibers of cotton blooming in the dirt farms, pulled, cleaned, and twisted into long strands. Even further, and the very substance of the cotton plant itself could be traced to those souls who had been laid to rest in its soil, feeding the roots with her own leather, while the air above baked under the full glory of powerful grow lights. Johns shook her head at her own morbidity. The older she got, the quicker her mind went to death. Always, in the end, the thoughts of death. With practiced care, she looped the end of the yarn around the point of one needle and crafted a triangle-shaped web with her fingers. The tip of the needle danced through this triangle, casting the yarn on. This was her favorite part, casting on. She liked beginnings. The first row. Out of nothing comes something. Since her hands knew what to do, she was free to glance up and watch a gust of morning wind chase pockets of dust down the slope of the hill. The clouds were low and ominous today. They loomed like worried parents over these smaller darting eddies of windswept soil, which tumbled like laughing children, twirling and spilling, following the dips and valleys as they flowed toward a great crease where two hills collided to become one. Here Johns watched as the puffs of dust splashed against a pair of dead bodies.
the frolicking twins of dirt evaporating into ghosts, solid, playful children returning once more to dreams and scattered mist. Mayor Johns settled back in her faded plastic chair.